Welcome everyone to this latest edition of the Council of Deans of Health podcast.
So my name is Dorothea Balchuks. I'm Senior Policy and Research Officer at the Council of Deans and leading our research work.
Today we're recording another podcast in our research month in February 2021. And I'm delighted that today we will be speaking to two very good friends from the NIHR who have been working with us for a long time actually on promoting research careers for nurses, midwives, and allied health professionals. So we have today with us Dr. Lisa Cottrell, CEO of the NIHR Academy, and Professor Anne-Marie Keenan, OBE, Associate Dean for the NIHR Academy. Welcome both, and thank you so much for joining me.
Pleasure, Dorothea.
Thanks for inviting us.
Thank you. If I can start with you, Lisa, can you say a little bit about how the NIHR has been supporting nursing, midwifery, and allied health professional researchers during this COVID period where there's been so much uncertainty and so much change going on?
Gosh, that's such an important question, Dorothea. I mean, it's been quite a challenging year, and we have seen so many of our clinical academics right across the board being moved out to the front line. I mean, particularly in the first wave, and it was rather immediate. So really early on in March and April, we saw a lot of our nurses and midwives being pulled into the front line, understandably. And you know, we're so impressed with the dedication that we've seen. But not only that, we've seen research that's been paused or slowed down. Some of the HVIs have been shut, so people can't carry on with their studies. And also all that childcare that many of our members have had to deal with as much as their research and their clinical commitments. So it was such a big sudden change. So the first thing that NIHR has been doing, and not just us but other funders as well, is try and be as reassuring as possible. It's a very scary time, and people are worried about their careers. So one of the things that we did early on was to reassure people by writing to trainees themselves, to institutions. We put some guidance out on our website, and we also worked with a lot of the other funders. So the guidance that went out there was very much a collective approach, not just NIHR on its own. So one of the things we've been asking people to do is just log their time out so we can kind of work out what's going on. But we've also tried to be as flexible as possible, and we encourage people to talk to us if they're worried. We can do things like modified projects, you know, just change it so that you can work around, you know, some of the difficult experiences. Even research blocks, people do clinical and academic, so we can move those around as well. You can do your research slightly later. Part-time arrangements, and we've also said that if necessary, we will extend your award. So we try to be as reassuring as possible. I think the challenge then was that some of our nurses and midwives were struggling to come back into their research careers, and particularly as they'd gone out so quickly, it wasn't terribly managed, and managing their return was also very challenging. And actually, because they're so good, a lot of the trusts want to let them go. So it was a bit of a struggle. So as we kind of hit that lull in the middle of September, and we started to think about, well, what happens if there's a second wave? So we again worked right across the funders, not just NIHR on its own, and published a whole set of new guidance. I mean, part of that was just some general principles that anyone that was being called to go out again to frontline clinical care, there must be a much more managed and considered approach. And it should be voluntary as well, that people weren't being expected just to drop everything and get on with it. And that's worked very well. We've had, you know, much more reasonable requests for people to move out, and also a kind of plan in terms of their return, which we felt was really important to this. The guidance is all on our website. You can have a look, and it's this guidance specifically for nurses, midwives, and allied health professions. With actions for R&D directors, the trusts, part of that is ensuring we are all flexible. Guidance for activities that HEI should be providing, what support they should be putting in place, also for ourselves as funders and for the trainees themselves. So, you know, we all have a part to play. This isn't just one person's responsibility. As it is with the second wave, we found very, very little disruption actually. I think with the first wave, you also experienced people going to the front line and then finding there wasn't much to do. So they were often backfilling other people's posts. So this time, I think people got a little bit bitten in the first wave. Second wave, it seems to be working out much, much better. But one thing I would emphasise, anyone that's worried or, you know, has concerns, we are trying really, really hard to support people the best way we can. So do contact us. You'll find a friendly face at the end of the phone, and I'm sure we can sort out any problem.
Yeah, I think that's very much appreciated. And I know throughout this time, actually, that people have found the flexibility that you've given to research is really, really helpful. And I think we've received a lot of very positive feedback about the NHR and how you've been handling it. Marie, did you want to add to that?
I also just wanted to add how very proud I was that the Academy in March had the ICA fellowship deadline, and we were one of the first of the funding bodies to actually push that back and to give people more time acknowledging the difficulty that people were having, particularly those people who we're targeting with the ICA program. And I think, you know, that was the beginning of, I think, what was a very important leadership role for the Academy to say, look, we understand how difficult this is and that we really want to be flexible and accommodate our emerging clinical academics.
Yeah. And Marie, I mean, do you think there are any challenges that remain, and how would you advise our members or the HGIs kind of to deal with them? I mean, thinking about supporting researchers who are facing this uncertainty right now, and people who had to pause their research or who just have very difficult personal circumstances during this time.
I think there are a number of challenges and a number of very significant challenges as we move forward, hopefully out of this lockdown and move into the kind of period where we're living with COVID as kind of a background noise. I think we have a number of challenges. I think people are really tired. I think people are exhausted. They're exhausted because of the kind of lifestyle changes that we've all had to make. They're exhausted because of the additional activities. And as Lisa was saying, when we've got childcare responsibilities on top of that, it just feels different at the moment than it did in March, April. And I think, you know, we have to be mindful of that. But we also have to be mindful that COVID is kind of nothing and it's everything, but it can't define us. And I think that I think the challenges in terms of research and research that's being put on hold, and I think that's the higher education institutions are being particularly affected by it, that, you know, we need to kind of rethink how we're doing things. And the, you know, the pandemic has been fantastic in enabling us and empowering us to do things differently. And, you know, we know that we can work remotely. We know that a lot of research can be done remotely. And I think, you know, it gives us a great opportunity to rethink things. And I think that it would be very unwise for us to think that we can just go back to how things were, and that I think we need to be mindful of the opportunities that we have, and we shouldn't, I don't think it's kind of healthy for us to think we'll just pause what we're doing and then start it again. I think that really is counterproductive. For example, we know that that recruiting patients, if we're relying on a traditional route of recruiting patients, we've had a lot of examples of where people have turned it on its head and used social media and used other ways of actually recruiting patients rather than waiting just for a referral. And I think that's really important in terms of diversity, you know, that we are kind of tapping into a different group. I think particularly for within the HEIs, my heart does go out, and I see this kind of on a daily basis, to the people who are doing teaching, scholarship and research contracts. I just think like everyone's having a tough time, but I think with the change of having to do a lot of turnaround teaching remotely, that has been an acute priority, and I am very concerned that the research is kind of often gets, it's an important priority, but not an immediate priority. And so it's around kind of rebalancing that. And I think as we get more used to online teaching, I think that that's going to balance itself out. And I think there's been some unintended messaging around the importance of teaching in HEIs, almost to the disadvantage of research. And I think that's been unhelpful, not intended, but it's been a very powerful message. So there's lots of barriers, but I also think there's great opportunities. We've been very keen that in terms of the Academy's role, that we really need to protect people. We really need to make sure that with things like fellowships, that it's such an integral part of personal development, that we have to protect those. We have to be very, very mindful of that, so that we have the researchers of the future who are going to be able to continue on. I guess we're really concerned that if this type of activity, if the fellowships are compromised, we'll have a really missed, we'll have a legacy problem. We absolutely and fundamentally committed to the ongoing development of our people. And I think that's been incredibly important.
Yeah, absolutely. And I know obviously a lot of our members have definitely found that, you know, the pressure on their staff has been phenomenal during this whole year. And I think it's been going on for such a long time now that a lot of people are really struggling with that. So yeah, really, really emphasize with that. Lisa, can you give us maybe a few insights that you can share from kind of recent funding or fellowship calls regarding the rate and the application rates and also the success of nursing, midwifery and allied health applicants?
That's a nice question, because Anne-Marie and I were reflecting this morning actually just how far we've come. Clinical academics in nursing, midwifery weren't even heard of, 10, 11 years ago. So since the beginning of our schemes, one of the things that we've always looked at is the kind of numbers that come through. You know, how attractive are these programmes? Are we getting the right numbers coming through? And what's the split? How many nurses? How many midwives? Are we reaching out sufficiently well? So we do look at the numbers, but we also look at the success rate. So how are people doing? I have to say, at the beginning of the schemes, the success rates weren't great because, you know, people didn't know what this was all about at the beginning. And we have moved on so much since then. The quality of applicants is actually eye-watering. They're so good. It's incredible. So we've been looking at some of the data. Between 2006 and March 2020, so fairly recently, if you take the cumulative data, the success rates for allied health professions were about 25%, which is not uncommon. It's around that for most funders. Doctors, around 22%. So, you know, there's often this view that, gosh, we can't compete with all these doctors. Actually, you can. Saying that, nurses are at 18% in that time period, with midwives around 25%, but the numbers are quite low. So it's very difficult to get the data in significance. So all in all, we were slightly concerned that the nurses were lower in terms of success rates. So as many of you may know, we conducted a strategic review of all of our programs in 2017, and that data was really quite impactful in terms of our thinking of where we would go with this. I think our sense with nursing is it's culturally different. You know, the exposure to any kind of academic experience at the early stages of a nursing career is very, very limited. Doctors, it's not, you know. So they don't have this exposure. Coming in at the early stages of career feels far more difficult and far more daunting. And they don't necessarily have the skills quite yet. So we set up a nursing and midwifery incubator. And the idea was that we would support the community to build confidence, to give lots and lots of advice and tips for success, how to put applications in, reach out to potential applicants. And it's been going for a couple of years now, and it is one of our most successful incubators, actually. We've been overwhelmed by support, which has been fun. So The data in 1920, much more recent, is allied health professionals are about 26%, again, doctors 23%. They've really got to pull those socks up, those doctors, I tell you. And be careful what you wish for, but the nurses are now 29%. And midwives were 50%, but the numbers are very low, so I would take that with a little bit of a pinch of salt. But, you know, we're absolutely delighted. And I have to say, this is only 1 year. And you're comparing against quite a few years. So you know, I'm not saying we've solved it by any means, and the incubator's certainly going to carry on. But I do think, you know, you guys, you're holding your own and then some. And I hope that message goes out, because sometimes it's just about confidence. If you don't think you can compete with other professions, then people don't even put applications in. So I think this is a really important message. The success rates are really very high. Quality of applicants, very, very high. Really, really excited about how the landscape has shifted since about 2006. It's crazy stuff, really. And the thing we're doing at the moment is looking at the barriers to career progression, because we do quite well at the pre-doctoral and the doctoral, but people moving into the post-doctoral level, so the clinical lecturers, senior clinical lecturers, the numbers are quite as high as we'd like to see. So there is a question about what makes it difficult to make that transition, and are we making our schemes attractive enough to bring people in? So we've been looking at that in more detail. There's quite a lot of evidence around that about, you know, reasons why that might be the case. So we're looking at possible changes at that level on the ICAS scheme, for example. And I think, you know, it is partly about maturing and learning. So we will never just sit on this. We're always going to move forward and try to do more. But it's been a great start, I have to say. I'm very excited about where we are.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, those are fantastic numbers. I think we can all be so proud of the progress that we've seen just these very few years, really. Yeah, fantastic. I mean, one of the things that we've been talking about in this community a lot is obviously kind of establishing a baseline and, you know, defining clearly what clinical academic is and what kind of the responsibilities are and what the role is of the HEI and the employer and so on. And I know that you've been working on a principles and obligations document that already exists for medics, actually, but you've been working on one for our professions as well. And obviously the council has been consulted on this document as well. And I think we're quite excited about the opportunity that this could give. And Marie, would you be able to say a bit more about what your intention is with this document and what this could change?
Yeah, and it certainly relates to what Lisa was saying about, you know, why do we have this drop-off in postdoc for our nurse and midwives, allied health professionals. And I think a key element for this has been you're kind of asking people to either sit in a university or in a trust. And we know that there are people who do both. And it should be around enabling people who want to be clinical academics and be based within the trust and university to be able to do that. And so similar to what the NIHR led on with the medics, it's around absolutely identifying what the obligations are for the host organisation. What the obligations are for the researcher, and what the obligations are for the funder, so that we're on a very we've got a very clear pathway of around that's absolutely around supporting the researcher and to make sure that they're being supported to do everything that they can. So this is absolutely fantastic. Just so excited about this document, because what it does is it enables and encourages flexibility of careers for their nurses, midwives and allied health professionals, pharmacists and healthcare scientists. So just as the doctors are able to hold either joint posts or posts within one organisation or the other, or indeed move between one organisation and the other, this document outlines how the researcher should be protected and should be supported in doing that. And it's around both organisations. When you've got someone who's being supported by a trust and a university, it's around both organisations being signed up to a personalised and integrated development plan. And acknowledging that this is critical for early career researchers. I think when you've become a bit old and crusty like me, you've got a bit of a loud voice and you can kind of stand up for yourself. But for the early career researchers, it's absolutely critical that they are protected. And it's also around not disadvantaging people. So if people, for example, move from a trust to a university for undertaking a PhD and they want to move back to a trust again, you know, they shouldn't be penalised for doing that. You know, we're also encouraging things like joint posts where you've got both organisations kind of supporting the person, and it really being around kind of joint appraisals, etc. So that's not in the document, but the commitment is to achieve a diverse clinical academic workforce, not just a whole bunch of medics who are doing research in that area. So I can't tell you how excited I am that this is going to be a step change to facilitate that, so that we can absolutely say that it is a responsibility of both organisations to support a clinical academic. And it's also around, you know, what funders, what we do as funders, and it's also about the expectation of the research. And it's just a lovely, clear document that is around the obligations of us all to support the clinical academics.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's what we see as well. I think it will really make things a lot clearer for all sides involved and kind of really establish that baseline, because there's still so much uncertainty around how do we set this up and what are the different responsibilities. So yeah, really positive, and obviously we encourage all of our members to take a look at that as well and to really embrace this new document. Great. Well, thank you both so much for taking the time to speak to me today. It's been absolutely fascinating. And obviously we're really, really grateful that we have such a close relationship with the NIHR, and kind of that I think our members really feel very supported by the programs that you've established. So thank you very much. And thank you all for listening, and obviously engage with the other activities and all the outputs that we've provided for our Research Month 2021, and that you can all find on our website. So thank you both, and have a good day.
Thanks, Sophia. Lovely.